From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Two of the most popular shows on American TV originated in other countries. On today's Fresh Air, we meet British producer David Briggs, who created Who Wants to Be a Millionaire? The game show premiered in the UK in 1998, and the format has been licensed to 80 countries. Survivor was the brainchild of British producer Charlie Parsons. He created the concept for the reality show called Survive, but he couldn't get anyone interested in it in Britain, so he sold it to a Swedish TV network. We'll talk with Parsons and with the Swedish producer who turned Parsons' idea into a hit series. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Barak has suffered a resounding defeat in his bid for re-election. As predicted, he lost by some 20 points to hawkish right-winger Ariel Sharon, though with the lowest voter turnout in Israel's history. NPR's Jennifer Ludden reports from Tel Aviv.
Sharon immediately telephoned Barak to ask him to share power in a unity government. Barak first said he'd consider the offer, but then announced he's stepping down as leader of the Labour Party and resigning his seat in Parliament. In an emotional concession speech, Barak told supporters his vision of compromise with the Palestinians is the only true solution. Israelis are not ready for the reality, he said, but we've shown the outline in which peace will eventually happen. At Sharon's Likud Party headquarters, jubilant supporters were convinced Sharon will now reverse course. Many say they want a more forceful approach to wring concessions from the Palestinians. One man said, the very name Sharon makes people shake. Nobody will mess with him. Jennifer Ludden, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
Lawmakers on Capitol Hill have announced a bipartisan plan for a patient's bill of rights. The measure is designed to create federal protections for patients in managed health care plans. It would give patients a modified right to sue their HMOs if they're denied care. President Bush said today that he appreciates the effort, but he wants a sharp limit on the amount of money that can be awarded to patients. White House aides have been encouraging Republican lawmakers not to back the plan. One GOP representative, Congressman Charlie Norwood, withdrew his support for the plan today, saying he'll wait until President Bush releases his own plan. Four major U.S. airlines face possible work stoppages this spring if current contract talks break down. Today, the president weighed in on the issue, urging them to settle their differences. NPR's Don Gagne reports.
Negotiations are underway for pilots at Delta, for mechanics at Northwest and United, and for flight attendants at American Airlines. Combined, these four companies carry about two-thirds of all domestic airline passengers a year. The president, at an appearance in McLean, Virginia, to promote tax cuts, was asked about the possibility of multiple strikes in the spring in the airlines industry.
I am worried about strikes at airlines. I think that would be could have a harmful effect on our economy. And I would urge that the parties settle their disputes. And the president has got some opportunities, if they're unable to do so, some opportunities available, and I'll explore all options.
In 1997, President Clinton ordered striking American Airlines pilots back to work, but the Bush administration says it's premature to talk about possible federal intervention at this point. Don Gagne, NPR News, the White House.
In stocks today, the Dow Industrials lost 8 points to close at 10,957 in moderate trading of 1.5 billion shares. This is NPR News. A jury in Charleston, South Carolina, has decided in favor of Brown and Williamson Tobacco Company in a smoking liability case. The family of a man who died from cancer sued the company, claiming that he was not protected by Carlton cigarettes, which are marketed as low in tar and nicotine. The family was asking for almost $1 million in medical costs and lost earnings for Martin Little, who died in 1999. A lawyer for the company told the jury that there was no evidence that Little didn't know about the dangers of smoking and that he didn't make an effort to quit smoking until he was diagnosed with cancer. Scientists say new evidence suggests the current surge of AIDS in southern Africa is not due to a super virus, as some thought. NPR's Richard Knox reports.
The last decade saw a new wave of AIDS sweep across southern Africa that led some scientists to wonder if HIV subtypes in these epidemic hotspots were transmitted more easily than earlier strains. But a new study presented at a meeting in Chicago found no difference between two HIV subtypes in Uganda. Both were transmitted at the same rate as the types in Thailand, which had its own explosive HIV epidemic. So what does explain Southern Africa's high HIV rates? One clue is that women in Uganda are much more likely to transmit HIV to men than vice versa. That's the opposite of North America and Europe. One study author says women in Southern Africa get infected earlier than elsewhere, and younger women are much more likely to transmit the virus. Richard Knox, NPR News, Boston.
In stocks today, the technology-heavy NASDAQ Composite Index gained 21 points to close at 2,665. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Sodexo Marriott Services, providing customized approaches to food and facilities management services in healthcare, education, and corporations. SodexoMarriott.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Two of the most successful TV programs in America originated in other countries, Survivor and Who Wants to Be a Millionaire. Today we'll talk with the creators of both shows. We'll start with Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, which was first broadcast in England in 1998. Here's the British host, Chris Tarrant.
The next question is for £64,000. You might as well play it. Here it comes. Which country has a test cricket ground called Kensington Oval? England. Australia. Jamaica. Barbados. You're five right answers away from £1,000,000.
Don't.
Now the thing is, now I know we've got an oval over here, but that's in Kennington, so it can't be there. So, I'll go B, Australia.
It's your choice, take your time.
Or is it Jamaica? Or is it Barbados? Jamaica.
Is that your final answer?
Yeah.
Oh, it's the wrong one. Fiona.
In case you're wondering, the correct answer was Barbados. The concept behind Who Wants to Be a Millionaire was dreamed up by my guest David Briggs. He created the format along with three colleagues. The show is broadcast on the ITV network in Britain. It's been licensed to about 80 countries and is currently on the air in 37 of them, including the U.S. Briggs was born in Wales in 1949. He's worked as a journalist, a producer of children's programs, music programs, current affairs, and game shows. He also produced a morning TV show hosted by Chris Tarrant, who became the host of the British version of Millionaire. I asked Briggs about his original concept for Who Wants to Be a Millionaire.
The very first thing that popped into my mind was the simple idea that putting people under pressure with a television camera right close to their face would be interesting. That was the very first thought. And then my second thought was, how much pressure can you put on somebody? And then how do you generate that pressure? And from those three basic thoughts, the beginnings of Millionaire came about, I think.
And was the $1,000,000 part of the whole pressure thing? Like, how to put pressure on somebody is to offer them $1,000,000 if they say the right stuff?
A million wasn't necessarily important. A large sum of money was important. It so happens that the million had never been done before, and it became a convenient vehicle because numerically the numbers split quite nicely. If you put 15 questions in, you go straight up to a million quite nicely with a little bit of mathematical adjustment. And so a million wasn't crucial. What was crucial was to put people in a position where it was enough money to make it very, very important.
Okay, let's talk about the design of Who Wants to Be a Millionaire. Why a multiple choice format?
Ah, that was terribly important. I mean, two important new things in a quiz show. One, A, multiple choice, and B, you show them the question and the four answers before they've got to decide what they want to do. That was in the very early plans, that, because that makes it much more tempting. Then you get to see the most important thing of this television programme is when that camera is right in those people's eyes, you can almost see inside their souls when they have to make the decision. You can see their eyes before the question comes up, their anticipation. They're about to see the next question. It's going to take them another step forward. They're going to see a question and four answers. And when you watch their faces, you can see sometimes instant recognition. The question comes up, they know the answer. They don't even have to see the answers offered to them. And sometimes the question comes up and they are blank. And you can see that complete crestfallen look come across their faces. That's what the show's all about. It's about complete emotion, real emotion, on a television set with real people. They're not people that are handpicked because they look good or because they sound good. They are real people making real decisions. It is a life drama in front of your eyes.
Now, they do have some options if they don't know what the answer is. There's 50-50 in which two of the answers are eliminated and two are left standing. They can poll the audience and see what the audience thinks, or they can use what in America is called a lifeline and what in the United Kingdom is called call a friend. You could have somebody standing by on the telephone and ask them what they think the right answer is and go with
Correct.
Their judgment. How did you come up with those options?
Well, what we found is when I first came up with the show, the idea was that you'd go from zero to £1 million, and each question would unfold, and you would just go all the way up. And what we had to do after we'd done some testing on this, we found that nobody was going to go all the way, and so we needed to give them certain special lifelines to help them make this journey. And the first thing we did was we put in two safe havens. One was at $1,000 and the second one was at $32,000. That meant if you get that far, that's safe, that money, which encouraged people to try and shoot for those safe havens. And secondly, what we did to try and help them get all the way to the big prizes, what we wanted to do was give them some helping hands, some lifelines. And those were the three that we felt were the best ones to help them out. I mean, they're all very different. You use them in different ways. They can be used very tactically. But we felt that they were the right things to try and get people to win big money. Because otherwise, the simple truth of the show was that everybody was going to pull out at a certain point when they couldn't go any further. The gambles were too much. And so we had to make ways to give them the chance to win more money.
Every country that licenses Who Wants to Be a Millionaire also gets the camera shots, the set, and the music.
Yes, when we license to any of the countries, we've now licensed to over 80 worldwide, they get a Bible, which is a very thick document, which tells them everything they need to do to make this show the success in their territory that it has been in others. And that includes set design, lights, the computers. There's an enormous computer system that runs behind the show that brings the question up, that when you do certain things in the show, it automatically drives some of the lights, some of the music cues are driven by the computer. So the whole computer system you have to get as well, plus the set design, how the lights work, and then lots of little tips about how to make this a fab show in your area, like simple things like how to treat the contestants. We try and make it a special day out for everybody who comes to our studio. Whether you take away nothing or you take away $1 million or £1 million, you're having the best day of your life. And people are looked after in a very special way so that they are in their dream world when they come to us.
Now, say I license it for my country, but I want to make some changes in your Bible. I don't want to treat the contestants nice, or I don't want to use your camera shots. I've got better shots of my own, and I've got better theme music too. Can I do that?
I think Terry would be talking to your competitor if that was your attitude.
So I have to go with the Bible if I like.
You have to go with the Bible. We've allowed in certain territories some changes to be made simply because the way we originally designed it is not applicable to that territory. But in
can you think of an example?
We've changed the name of the show marginally in some countries, although the logo has to remain the same. Unfortunately, if you do this show in Turkey, for example, you'd have to rename it to Who Wants to Be a Billionaire, because a million Turkish lira is not worth very much, or Italy is exactly the same. So we've had to make subtle changes like that in some countries. But basically, throughout the world, wherever millionaires on, you should see, even if you don't understand the language, you should be able to sit down and watch that program, for example, in India or in Japan, and say, I know what's going on. All the music's the same. The logo will be the same. You'll know what the program is. And I tell you, I've watched it in foreign languages, and you can tell exactly what's going on. You can see exactly where the presenter is, because the money tree is the same in every country. So you know whereabouts they are in the game. And you can see by the presenter's voice when he says, is that your final answer? In some foreign language, you know what he's saying. Because you can tell by the contestant's face.
Is that part of the Bible, too, that you're supposed to say, is that your final answer?
It's suggested that that some close derivative in your language should be used. A lot of the bits of the language of the show, like, is that your final answer, and phone a friend, and 50-50, and things like that, or we say over here things like, Chris always says to people, like, you've won £32,000, but we don't want to give you that. We want to give you more money. Those things have gone into the language over here, and we do just show people in other countries how Chris Tarrant, who's the English presenter, how he does things. And most of the presenters worldwide seem to think that he's got it pretty darn right, and so they pick up on a lot of those things.
Are there any things that Regis Philbin says in the United States that you enjoy that are that were originated for the American version of Millionaire?
There are some differences. Regis has now edited our version, which is that your final answer? Down to final, which I suppose is a sort of American short form. You all across the Atlantic there like to say everything much, much quicker than us. We like to drag it out. And Chris can make that, is that your final answer, as, you know, five words last 15 seconds if he wants to. And I like that sort of drama. But that in America, that you just have it as final, which has also its own attraction. One of the differences over here is that we have a... Chris Tarrant, who's the English presenter, has a very close relationship with the contestants, which doesn't sometimes come over with Regis as much. I mean, Regis does, but I think Chris, for example, will go over when somebody's just made it to 32 or 64, whatever it is, and hug them, you know, be it man or woman, hug them. And Chris is just all over them with excitement and joy. And I understand that Regis kind of saw Chris doing this and said, hey, that looks really good. I'd like to try that. And the first time he did it, apparently the contestant didn't take too kindly to it. And so he's had to back off doing it now, which I think says a lot about the American culture versus ours, probably.
I wonder if the British host Chris Tarrant wears clothes that look quite as expensive as Regis Philbin's do.
Yes, the famous, what is now, I believe, known in America as the Regis look, actually started with Chris Tarrant in this country, and that look of the suit with the matching tie and shirt started over here, and that is virtually part of the Bible as well, I have to say.
So people in India and Turkey, when they're hosting Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, have to wear ties the same color as their shirt.
I think it's pretty much international, that, yes. We had a lovely get-together of about 30 of the presenters down in the south of France last year, a sort of big thank-you party, and it was like a whole line of people all dressed up exactly the same. It was very bizarre to see. So, yes, they know. I think by and large, they do all wear the same things. And I remember at that get-together, I think it was the guy from Russia came up to me, and through an interpreter, he said, first of all, I want to thank you for inventing this show, because it's been great for me and I had a wonderful time. And he said to me something along the lines of, can you tell me why Chris puts his hands together in front of him at the start of the show? Is this some key to how we get big ratings? And I said, no, actually, it's to stop him putting his hands in his pockets. And we actually sew up the trouser pockets of Chris's trousers so he can't put his hands in his pockets. And so he has to put them somewhere, so he puts them in front of him. And they several people have, you know, tried to notice things like that and thought they were, you know, little tricks to get a bigger audience, but they're not at all.
You know what I'm wondering? You've talked about how the camera should be really close to the contestant's face, and a lot of the show is about the pressure that's on the contestant and the drama of watching them. Are there cultures in which it would be considered impolite to put the camera that close, or impolite to create quite that much pressure in a public situation?
I don't think I've heard of any examples, Terry, where it's considered impolite. We do have some national differences. For example, the shows that go out in the Middle East, when a woman appears, she has to have her face covered, as they do in Arab countries. But the one thing that has to be exposed is the eyes, and it's the eyes that tell it all. I mean, if you can have the camera look into their eyes, you can see pretty much down into their soul. You don't need the rest of the face. The rest of the face is a bonus. But I don't think we've found anywhere where the show has been perceived to be intrinsically insulting in any way to the culture of the society. I think we've just found things where we've had to get around little sort of problems such as the Arab show, but it hasn't affected it at all. I mean, the show that grows out in the Middle East is one of the biggest rating shows in the world.
If you're just joining us, my guest is David Briggs, and he is the creator of Who Wants to Be a Millionaire. He created it for the United Kingdom, and now it's licensed around the world, including, of course, in the United States. Let's take a short break here, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. David Briggs is my guest, and he created Who Wants to Be a Millionaire. He created it in England for ITV, and now it's been licensed around the world and, of course, is broadcast in the United States. How did you first come up with your plan for auditioning contestants for Who Wants to Be a Millionaire? What was that process initially like?
Well, the great thing is, Terry, is that there is no audition. This is the one show where, because of the way we run our entry system, which is people make a phone call, they answer a question, then a computer picks 100 of the people who have answered the question correctly. It then asks that, then we go back, we ask them a second question, and whoever's closest to the right answer gets on the show. There is no audition. That's why you get everybody, all walks of life, all sorts of people. There is no beauty contest to get on this show. Anybody can get on. You know, be you a beggar or a king, anybody can get on. And that's why the audience identifies with them, because they say, it could be me there. It could be me sitting there.
You know, but there was criticism in the United States during the first season that the contestants were overwhelmingly white and male.
We've had some of that criticism here as well. And I can only say, I can't create the contestants. They have to create themselves. And if the people who call in are by and large white and male, then that's what you're going to end up with on the show. It's open to everybody. Everybody's got the same chance. And whoever calls in and gets all the questions right and the computer picks them, which is a completely random computer. I want to make this absolutely clear. There is no selective process at all. Then we get what we're given.
Now, since you don't audition the people beforehand and you don't know what they look like or how they sound, how their personal hygiene is, have you ever been really surprised and kind of scared by some of the contestants who have showed up?
Oh, yes, indeed, Terry, I have. We have had people from the very north of Scotland, for example, or indeed people from Northern Ireland, have very, very thick accents, which I personally, and sometimes Chris, finds hard to understand. But we just have to live with that. We have had people who have had personal hygiene problems, which we just have to live with. You know, they just turn up. What they do is they find out the day before they go on the air that they're going to be on. I think in America it's like two days. And then we fly them in to London, in our case, and we put them on the show, and we meet them for the first time 12 hours, less than that, 8 hours before we record the show. We have a chat with them. We try and clean them up a bit, give them a bit of a brush down, and, you know, put their clothes on, make sure they look nice, and out they go. And, you know, but it's their clothes, it's their hairdos, it's everything. That's just them. We have had a few problems, but nothing, you know.
Tell me about some of the problems.
Well, only, are they tiny things? I mean, they're not worth talking about. I mean, just, you know, people who, you know, you would rather not. Chris has said to me that he'd rather not, you know, hug them as viciously as he might after a big win, because they're not as pleasant to hug as other people, let's put it that way. And people who, you know, we've had people in wheelchairs, we've had people who are, you know, partially sighted, who have trouble, you know, reading the fastest finger first screen. And so we've had to put Braille on that and things like that. But they're all problems that you just eventually overcome, and none of them are too much.
Who designs the questions? And what does the Bible say about how the questions should be designed?
Okay. There is a sort of millionaire question. These will vary from territory to territory. The one thing we can't do here in the UK is write the questions. And that's simply because, you know, what to me is an easy question in England is obviously going to be very difficult, different level of difficulty in the United States. So we can't even write questions for the same language. So we leave it to the individual territories. But we do believe there is a good sort of millionaire question, which I always think, especially when you get to the higher levels of money, should be, educationals may be overstating it, but you should go, I'm really interested to know what the answer to that question is. I'm really interested to know the sort of person who would know the answer. What we do in this country is we have a team of six or seven full-time employees at the company, at Celador, whose job it is to write questions. They just write questions, and they write fastest finger first questions, and they write questions for all the different levels. And then myself and Paul Smith, who's the chief executive of the company, we go away and hide in the corner for a long time, and we then argue like mad about which questions should go in which positions in the game. And that is a very subjective judgment. You know, it's somebody's view as to what's an easy question and what's a hard question, and we just hope we get it right more than we get it wrong.
Well, you know, I was watching, I got to see one episode of the British version of Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, and one of the questions was, Jay Silverheels played which character in a TV Western? And I had no idea whether the answer, which was Tonto, would be an easy one to come up with in England, since that was an American TV show. I didn't know whether this would be Arcania in England or something that everybody knew.
That was kind of a bit of a hard question. That was a very long time ago, that show, and I do remember it. But it was, I mean, certainly everybody would know who Tonto was in The Lone Ranger. Whether they'd know about Jay Silverheels was, that was, you know, a bit tough, I agree. And it was for quite a lot of money, as I remember, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think so. And yet, one of the easy questions, one of the, like, this wasn't an easy one. This was a fastest finger qualifying round question.
Yeah.
It was like, put the parts of a horse in the order that they appear anatomically, and I didn't even recognize two of the words.
Well, that's because you don't, you know, go out riding with the queen like we do over here.
That's what I figured. That's what I figured. David Briggs is the creator of Who Wants to Be a Millionaire. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Holland America, offering cruises to destinations worldwide, including the Caribbean, the Panama Canal, Alaska, and Europe. On the web at hollandamerica.com. And from Wilmington Trust, recognizing worth in individuals and in unique programs like Fresh Air. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Who wants to be a millionaire?
Coming up, more with the creator of Who Wants to Be a Millionaire. Then we meet the creator of Survivor, British producer Charlie Parsons. When he couldn't find a British network willing to buy his idea, he sold it to a Swedish network. We'll also meet the Swedish producer of the show.
Wallow in champagne. Who wants a supersonic plane? Who wants a private landing field too? I don't. All I want is you.
¶¶
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with David Briggs, the British producer who created the concept of Who Wants to Be a Millionaire and co-created the format. The program first aired in England in 1998 and has since been licensed to countries around the world. What are the most controversial questions that you've had on the British version of Millionaire?
I'm going to confess to you now, Terry. We did get a question once where we got it wrong. We didn't get it wrong, but there were two possible answers. And it was a question about tennis. And I can't remember the detail of it, but it was about what's the least number of strokes you can win a set of tennis in, I think was the question. And it depended on whether you were serving or not serving, and we got it wrong. And I can't say, the flood of calls was astronomical and awful. And since then, we've learned to check our questions very much more carefully. That was a very long time ago. So what we do now, every question that's written has to have four independent sources that verify that the question is correct. And also, we have to verify that the three other answers are incorrect, which is also very, very important. So we do take great care over our questions now.
What about the security of the answers to make sure that there's no cheating?
Well, that's quite easy. What happens is very simple. We write all the questions first. They all go into the computer. Currently on Millionaire, which is we're on air at the moment in England, we are running with about 3,250 questions in the computer across all, you know, all the different levels and all subjects. Now, of all those questions, and that computer, there are only two people who have access to that computer, for number one. And secondly, the computer is being upgraded all the time. Even if you could get into that computer, which is not linked, by the way, to any internet site at all, it's the only computer that I know of that doesn't have any link to the outside world. Even if you could get in there, even if you knew all the passwords and did get in there, you'd then have to memorize 3,500 questions and answers, which are changing all the time. But secondly, so the important bit is that when it comes to showtime, what I do is I go in at exactly 10 minutes before we start recording, and it's only then that I build the stacks of questions. So I decide, you know, I don't build it at all. The computer does it for me. It just goes, you just press a button, say, build a stack, and it builds a question from 1 to 15, and you just look at it and check it. I always check it through to make sure there's nothing in there that could be, you know, insensitive due to the news of the day or something like that. If that's okay, that's the stack, and that's stack one for the first contestant. Now, you know, I don't know how you're going to ever find out what those 15 questions are, because you're already sitting in the seat downstairs ready to go on. That's the sort of security we have, Terry. It's very tight. Don't even think about trying to fix it.
Do you have any kind of insurance policy, say with Lloyd's of London, having to do with making sure you have enough prize money to give out or anything else like that?
We did. We used to. We started off with an insurance policy. We don't bother with it anymore. I think in most territories, most television companies find that this show is so successful that the advertising by itself pays for any prize money that they need to give out. And remember, you see, what the first problem we had with Millionaire was convincing somebody that, you know, we weren't going to be giving away £1 million every night. And all they had to do was look at simple human nature. If I said to you now, Terry, you've got $250,000. Okay, it's yours. You can take it right now. That's $250,000. That's even a lot to a rich woman like you, Terry. Now, yet that money is safe, okay? You just got it there, it's safe. But here's a question. I tease it in front of you, and I ask you what your mother's middle name is, and you probably know. You're absolutely convinced. But would you gamble? Would you just take that chance? And that's why this is not an expensive show, because at the end of the day, it's human frailty. It's my lack of self-belief in what I know that makes you say, I'll just take the money, thank you.
Is that what you were counting on?
Absolutely.
How many people have actually won the full million in England?
In England, just one.
Just one?
Just one. A lady called Judith Keppel won it just slightly earlier this year, and she is the only one. We've had four people win half a million, but just one go all the way to the million.
What about in other countries?
Oh, well, in America, we've got loads of them.
So what's the difference? Why is that true?
Well, $1 million isn't as much as £1 million for a start, is it, Terry? But there have been millionaire winners in France, in Germany, in Japan, in Israel. I think that probably maybe the Americans are braver. I think they've got certainly... they're much more imbued with the culture of the game show and with the idea of playing for money. You know, I mean, years ago there was the $64,000 question, all those sort of things. And I think probably my proudest achievement in life is after having come up with Millionaire, is to have sold a game show to America. I mean, you just don't do that. We Brits are, you know, limeys who are not very good at this sort of thing. But to have, you know, sold a show successfully into the American market proves that maybe we're not so bad after all.
I figure one of the reasons why so many people watch Who Wants to Be a Millionaire is that you imagine yourself being the contestant on the show, and then you imagine how much money you could have won if you were the contestant.
I think that's absolutely true. Most people who come into the studio say to me, it's so much easier at home. You know, and everybody plays along with it at home. It's got great shoutability, this game. The reason that it works with the audience is that they are sitting there shouting the answers out, and they're saying, oh, gosh, why can't this person understand? I know this, why can't they? Or they're sitting back in awe and saying, how did the person know that? I mean, I'm amazed. But everybody who comes along says, oh, you know, I reckon I can get to 32,000. The trick is, Terry, the trick is when you're sitting in the chair and you're faced with the decision, do you want to chance that money you've won? Do you really know the answer to the next question? That's when it all becomes very, very different.
Well, David Briggs, thank you so much for talking with us.
It's a pleasure, Terry. Thank you very much for your time.
David Briggs is the creator of Who Wants to Be a Millionaire? Coming up, the creator of Survivor. This is Fresh Air.
Klara, färdiga, gå!
The show we know as Survivor originated on Swedish TV as the program Expedition Robinson. It was dreamed up by the British producer Charlie Parsons, but he couldn't interest a British TV network in buying the idea. So he sold it to Swedish Public Broadcasting and used their show as the pilot for versions in other countries. Parsons went on to become the executive producer of the American version, along with Mark Burnett. Parsons also created the British late-night show The Word and was the executive producer of the BBC's first gay magazine show. With Bob Geldof, he co-founded the British production company Planet 24. I asked Parsons how he came up with the idea for Survivor.
Well, Survivor has been a long-running project. I guess over 12 years ago, I sent, for a program I did in the UK, I sent four people to a desert island, just followed them through. It was really a conventional documentary, I suppose you could say, although taken in small parts. And it worked so well that the idea lingered with me, and I thought this must be something I could turn into a real proper entertainment show. A few years later, I developed it a bit more, and then after the success of a program I did over here, I was brought to America, and I developed it for Buena Vista Television further. And that finally kind of fine-tuned all of the parts of the program, dotted the I's and crossed the T's, so to speak. And the result was what we called then Survive. That's really the origin of the idea.
Now the show is on in how many countries?
The show's on in about 20 countries around the world, and there's about another 20 who are expressing an interest. In some places, I say 20 countries, there's two countries who are clubbing together because of the sort of high budget of it. They need to club together. It's a growing and worldwide format. And it's fair to say that since the success of America, there's been even more interest than there was before.
Now, does the show have a Bible telling each country what they have to do to produce the show?
Basically, the show has a very strict format description and then a very clear Bible, which basically is constantly updated based on the experiences of each producer. When we license it, which is what we do, we basically license producers to produce it for a certain number of years. When we license it, they're obliged to provide us with any information on difficulties or experiences that they've had, which could basically work towards, if you like, the common good of making the program the most successfully and most enjoyably.
What are some of the things you've gotten in response to that?
Well, I mean, at its sort of simplest level, on the first series, when we filmed the first series, they filmed it, and funnily enough, exactly the same place as the first series of Survivor was filmed for the USA. They realized pretty quickly that there was a big problem on the beach with sand flies. These sand flies basically were causing great grief amongst the Swedish contestants and basically making them talk about almost nothing else, which obviously wasn't great TV by itself. So we knew that when it actually came to doing the next edition, either in that place or elsewhere, we wanted to make sure that the area wasn't dominated by some species, which was going to mean that the people who were participating couldn't talk about anything else. I mean, that's an example of how, you know, collective information came back to us and told us exactly things that we needed to correct in order to make a better second edition, if you see what I mean.
Now, what does the Bible for Survivor say about how to cast contestants for the show?
Well, what we wanted to do always, and indeed I think it says it right in the very front page of the format document, was to cast contestants from all walks of life. We really felt it strongly that they needed to represent every aspect of society, rich or poor, young and old. We wanted to make sure that it wasn't just a game about physical endurance, but also about mental endurance. We wanted to make sure also that, you know, there were all sorts of moral issues, if you like, looked at because of the representation. And that's the basic rule we wanted in the Bible for casting of the program.
Now, I'm wondering if the Bible suggests that you should try to get somebody who's a real pest or who's incredibly neurotic, so that there's somebody who can be like the first person voted off the island or the person that everybody gangs up on.
Well, actually not really. I mean, obviously we're looking for characters and we're looking for scenarios. It doesn't say that in the Bible. It's a TV producer's instinct to look for the most interesting people, and the most interesting people in a group like this are the most interesting people who can create a group dynamic or bounce off it. Certainly, as character is such a big part of the show, you know, all the games and all the activities that we devised were designed to bring out characteristics, but I don't believe that it actually says word for word, we're looking for somebody who's neurotic. I guess it's implicit, though.
Does the Bible have anything to say about how attractive the contestants should be, or how many of the contestants need to be attractive?
No, not at all. I mean, we're very keen that the contestants should be from all walks of life. I mean, but we do have found that some countries prefer to have, you know, subjectively, seem to prefer to have more younger people than others.
Now, I think part of what's going on in Survivor is that you've got these people on these, you know, hot desert islands, and they're not wearing a lot of clothes. So you see them go through all this physical and emotional duress while wearing bathing suits. did you think of that as part of the appeal?
Oh, undoubtedly. I mean, that I would be lying if I didn't say. I mean, it's everybody's dream to go onto a desert island and go native. I mean, you know, if you like, that's almost where the idea came from in a strange way. You know, here we are. Here I am in grey Britain with grey skies. You know, nothing could be better than the idea of going onto a desert island. And, you know, hence it's been a sort of universal fantasy from literature to movies to television, from Robinson Crusoe to Gilligan's Island. So, of course, you know, that idea of being free in an island environment, but also, you know, wandering around without your clothes and not knowing what's going to happen to you. I mean, that all comes into it. You know, it's a fairy tale fantasy, if you like.
And, of course, for the viewers, it's a way to watch often some very attractive people not wearing a lot of clothes.
Well, yes, I would be. I mean, it is a way of watching that. But then, on the other hand, so was Beverly Hills 90210. You know, I don't think it's that new in TV circles, I guess.
Right. Well, I'm wondering if you're on in certain countries where the culture of the country is much more modest than, say, the United States, and they have to clothe themselves more.
Well, I'd actually say, so far not, but funnily enough, we're just in the process of negotiating with a Middle Eastern country. And that, of course, raises a whole load of issues which haven't been raised before. We haven't got to face them yet. But, I mean, it raises, obviously, the issue of sexes working together. It raises the issue of how much you can and can't see. There's a whole load of things which will come out of it, I'm sure. But so far, I think it's fair to say that the countries we've actually sold it to have tended to be Western countries, some of whom are more liberal than the United States in what they can show on television.
Has the Middle Eastern country in question, have the producers there already expressed certain concerns to you? And if so,
not at all. No, I'm not at all. No, they haven't mentioned that at all, but I would be very surprised if that didn't come up. We've just basically they want to do the program. They love the program. I expect it will. Maybe it won't. Maybe I'm completely wrong. It'll be quite interesting to see what happens.
What does the Bible for Survivor say about where the producers are supposed to draw the line between what's televised and what's not? For example, if two people were having sex, that would probably not be shown. If somebody is relieving himself or herself, that would probably not be shown. Where do you draw the line?
Well, that actually, the line being drawn for what people do is actually not something which we can put in the production Bible, not least because different countries have entirely different standards. But what we do say is that we believe the program to be a moral program, and we want the program to be a quality program. We don't set out to be sensationalist. We set out more to be almost a social experiment. And so that the line is drawn very much at the discretion of the individual producers. But then in selecting the people who might license the program from us, we make selections based on the quality of their output before. And we don't want it to be in the least bit damaging to the format internationally.
Could you ever imagine yourself being a contestant on Survivor? Is this the kind of thing that would suit your personality?
It absolutely would not suit my personality at all. I can't think of anything worse than being a contestant on Survivor. One, because I'm quite private and don't really want to sort of see myself being filmed all day, and I certainly don't look good enough. And secondly, because actually, you know, I quite like comforts, home comforts, and there aren't very many home comforts if you're sent to be by yourself for a long period of time.
Now, you said that you don't think you look good enough to be a contestant on Survivor. I thought that didn't matter.
It doesn't matter, but I can. Just to be on TV is difficult enough. It doesn't matter, but I'm conscious of it enough to do it. I think that, you know, those are the sort of things you become conscious of. That's why I wouldn't apply.
The creator of Survivor, you, and the creator of Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, David Briggs, are both British. Is England a particularly good laboratory for game shows?
I think it's a very strange coincidence that we're both British, but I think that one of the reasons that kind of creativity in television comes out of Britain is that until recently television was dominated very strongly by a public service ethos where creativity wasn't measured immediately in audience research, which is what tends to happen in other countries, but was measured in enthusiasm for an idea. So you could get an idea onto television because one visionary person thought this is really interesting or different and didn't look at the audience research, which they'd already got, to say, oh, the audience doesn't like this and they only respond to that. So I guess that's probably the reason why the Who Wants to Be a Millionaire and Survivor come from the same country. But having said that, obviously the real home for the game show, the real birthplace of the game show, is America. And I think all we've probably respectively done is put a spin on it and resold it back there.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Pleasure. Really nice. Thank you very much.
Charlie Parsons is the creator of Survivor. By the way, the show still isn't on in his own country, England. Coming up, the Swedish producer who turned Parsons' concept into a hit show. This is Fresh Air. When the British producer Charlie Parsons couldn't find a British TV network willing to buy his idea for the show Survivor, he sold it to Swedish Public Broadcasting, where it was named Expedition Robinson and was first broadcast in 1997. It became a big hit and was used as the blueprint for the American show Survivor and for other versions around the world. Anna Brokenhielm is the Swedish producer behind Expedition Robinson. During the first season of Expedition Robinson, the first person voted off the island shortly after was hit by a train and killed in what was assumed to be a suicide. This was before the show was broadcast. I asked Brokenhielm her reaction to his death.
I haven't found out yet that he committed suicide, but because the police haven't stated it was a suicide, so I'm not the one who should tell, but it was a big shock for all of us who was involved that he died a month after the production was ended, and because we liked him all, and of course it was terrible.
After the person died or committed suicide, what did you do with the footage of them? Did they remain in the series, or did you edit them out of the series?
The broadcaster decided to merge the two first episodes, so it shouldn't be that much focus on that person, just to protect his family. So the two first episodes were cut together in one episode. So that was what we did. So we did some re-editing.
I see. Did you add any kind of psychological counseling or intermediary help or whatever for the people voted off the island so that they wouldn't either be terribly embarrassed or self-conscious or whatever they're going through afterwards?
Okay, we take very good care of them after they have been voted off. And you never send someone home alone, for example, and they are allowed to stay at a hotel together with the crew or at another hotel together with other contestants and just stay for a couple of days so they don't go directly back. And we also have psychiatrists talking to them afterwards. And now it's easier because the show is so well known and all the contestants who come and compete, they know perfectly well what's going to happen. So it was difficult the first season because nobody had seen the show and nobody could be prepared on what's going to happen.
What's one of the more tense moments that you experienced on the set of Survivor, where you thought something might go seriously wrong?
Yeah, the third season we were recording in Philippines, very far away from everything. The only way to get there was with small planes that could take maximum 8 people. And we had a typhoon that started just 10 hours after we have sent out the teams on the islands. And it was really, really difficult to evacuate the contestants. So we had to evacuate them.
Oh, you had a typhoon?
Yes, and we had to have them out there and just stop the production for 6 days waiting for the typhoon to get over. So it was really terrible. And we were recording for 3 countries at the same time on 7 different islands. So it was a huge organization, and we just stopped for 6 days waiting for this typhoon to get away.
Did you see the typhoon?
Yeah, I was there. I was stuck on an island for 2 days, couldn't get away. But nobody was injured or something like that. It was just that they were freezing and cold and wet.
How discouraging is that? I mean, did it dampen your enthusiasm for the project, or did you just feel equally enthusiastic once the typhoon stopped?
It's more like if you have a responsibility as a CEO for a company and you're producing for millions and millions and millions for 3 broadcasters in 3 countries, you're a bit scared that the production wouldn't be finished in time. It's more that. And as soon as you had all the contestants back in safety and all the crew members back in safety, it was just to sit down and calculate on budgets and see if it would be possible to fulfill the production or not. That was my greatest concern at that time. And so it's also organizational problems. When you have 150 crew members who are not working for 6 days, it starts a lot of problems.
Where do the camera people sleep, and where do you sleep when you're on the island? Do you sleep with the other contestants, or are you someplace else?
No, we never stay at the same island as the contestants because we want them to be totally alone. So we would never do like we did in America the first season to have a resort on the same island as the contestants because you don't get the feeling that they are alone. Mm-hmm. So we arrive early in the morning by boat. It's just the cameraman and the reporters and nobody else should talk to the contestants. You stay with them until you have your material and then you go back home and they are totally alone.
Who else is waiting in the wings in case they're needed?
We have a head of security and we have... we are recording actually three productions at the same time. So we have two doctors and two nurses. And then it's a lot of production people who are always around. And we also have guards, night guards, who patrol the island. They don't go too close to the camp, but they are close with radio communication. So they can get rescued if something happens.
How much does the winner get? What's the prize?
Oh, in Sweden it's not that much. It's only $50,000.
Wow, because it's $1 million here.
I know. It's a big difference, but this is a public broadcaster. They can never get any advertising money or never any sponsors. So even though it's the biggest national broadcaster, they don't get any extra for having this success, so it's difficult to have such a huge amount of money. If it was a commercial broadcaster, of course the prize money would be more.
Now, the ratings for Survivor have been quite extraordinary in the United States. How have the ratings for Expedition Robinson been?
It's just amazing. The final episode now, we had, out of a population of 8.5 million, we had 4 million viewers. So it was... Yeah, almost 50% of the total population of the country who are watching the final episode now.
Well, I thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Anna Brokenhielm is the Swedish producer of Expedition Robinson, the blueprint for the show Survivor. Our program on Survivor and Who Wants to Be a Millionaire was produced by Monique Nazareth. I'm Terry Gross. We'll close with music by trombonist J.J. Johnson. He died Sunday at the age of 77. His death was reported as a suicide. We'll feature an interview with him from our archive later this week.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Random House Incorporated's Bantam Division, publisher of Total Memory Workout, 8 Easy Steps to Maximum Memory Fitness by Cynthia R. Green. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Mark Salzman about his new novel, Lying Awake. It's about a Carmelite nun who learns that her mystical visions may be the result of epilepsy. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.